Society lady. She's really wonderful. One of the jokes she does is she has this little mock question-answer session, and she says, acts like she's one member of the ward and says, now, I've got a question. If I wear my garments inside out, will I suck danger unto me? I think it's a great line. So I used it in the newsletter, made it a letter to the editor, picked the wrong person, and got a nice chatting to the other week. 2 years ago, Brian Waterman and I were at BYU. I don't know how many of you know Brian Waterman. He's now a PhD student in... let's see, is there anything we can do with this? Okay. Brian Waterman and I were at BYU. I was the editor of BYU's official newspaper, The Daily Universe. Brian Waterman, who's now at Boston College studying American Studies, a PhD program, he was the editor of BYU's unofficial newspaper, The Student Review. We were on opposite sides of the camera. He was leading protests when Cecilia Conchar-Farr and David Knowlton were fired. I was taking the pictures. I was reporting. He was subverting the university, and I was pushing forward their propaganda. We, strangely enough, became friends. When I graduated from BYU, I was hired on at Sunstone. And so this, of course, changed my worldview dramatically. Brian Waterman and I have always been very interested in academic freedom issues, in contemporary Mormon issues. And so our friendship was immediate. It was something that we both benefited from. We both have different perspectives. And last year at the Sunstone Conference in Burbank, we presented our first session on the Farr Knowlton academic freedom stuff. Some of you may have been there. Since then, we've presented several other episodes in this ongoing saga at different conferences. We've decided to pull this together into a book-length manuscript, see if anybody wants it. Maybe this will come out in a hardbound version down the road. Of course, this makes it challenging. When you're writing a book-length manuscript, you've got so much information, and when you have to distill it into a 40-minute session, you lose a lot, you compress a lot, some things become a little skewed. So if you have any questions, please hold on to them. Grab me afterwards or during the question and answer session. I'll try and clarify anything that doesn't make sense. So with that, I'll just forge forward a tale of two statements. During the nearly 120 years since BYU was founded, its main identity crisis has been in determining the status of academic freedom. This ever-present challenge has entered the public realm from time to time, as in 1911, when professors William Chamberlain and Henry Peterson were dismissed for teaching evolution and unorthodox biblical interpretation, or 70 years later, when tenured BYU professor of history Michael Quinn resigned, explaining, "The situation seems to be that academic freedom merely survives at BYU without fundamental support from the institution." Or later that year, when David Wright, who was described in his termination notice as an exceptionally bright scholar and teacher, was denied tenure for holding, but not teaching, unorthodox views on the 19th century origins of the Book of Mormon. Or 2 years ago, of course, with the firings of David Knowlton and Cecilia Conchar-Farr. BYU and other private religious schools have always been able to claim certain exemptions to the university academic freedom tenet. At the same time, however, symposia. One Friday in August 1991, just 2 weeks following the Sunstone Symposium in Salt Lake City, the church released a statement known simply as the Statement on Symposia. Although the statement didn't mention Sunstone specifically, it clearly referenced several sessions from the recent symposium. The session, LDS Garments, A View from the Outside, by non-Mormon University of Utah professor Colleen McDaniel, seemed to correspond with the passage, quote, "Recent symposia have included some presentations relating to the house of the Lord, the holy temples, that are offensive. We deplore the bad taste and insensitivity of these public discussions of things we hold sacred," end quote. Another paper on continuing problems of terrorism against the church in South America by anthropologist David Knowlton seemed to be linked to, quote, "Some of the presentations have included matters that were seized upon and publicized in such a way as to injure the church or its members or to jeopardize the effectiveness or safety of our missionaries." Still another session, end quote. Still another session by Weber State Professor John Sillitoe on the excommunication of Apostle Richard Lyman seemed to correspond with, quote, "We believe that Latter-day Saints who are committed to the mission of the Church and their well-being and the well-being of their fellow members will strive to be sensitive to those matters that are more appropriate for private conferring and correction than for public debate." The media. Media response was immediate and predictably varied. The church-owned Deseret News ran the statement in its entirety without so much as an editor's note to provide context. Sunstone editor Albert Peck and publisher Daniel Rector issued a statement that the church that the Salt Lake Tribune ran, quote, "We are very sorry if some deliberations at our symposia gave offense or were interpreted as detracting from the mission of the church. Our intent is to conduct thoughtful discussions of religious questions in the spirit of goodwill. We believe that, in the long run, an open and honest examination of varied perspectives of the Latter-day Saints and their friends helps to build the kingdom of God," end quote. Several weeks later, during General Conference weekend, an Associated Press story headlined, "LDS Church Turns Up Heat and Feud with Intellectuals." Mike Quinn observed, historian Mike Quinn, "Consistently from the beginning, the church's leadership has been uncomfortable with open forums that have been organized by the rank and file." Quinn later added, "In the 19th century, the leadership recognizes the existence of a loyal opposition, and the 20th century does not." The church's response. The brethren usually remain silent during times of media scrutiny, and they did so in this situation as well. They declined interview requests, but released a written statement, which did little more than define what dissent meant. The definition given was conflict, discord, strife, objection, protest, rebellion, contradiction, or to differ, disagree, or oppose. Those members whose actions fit those definitions subject themselves to the possibility of church discipline, whether it be formal, like a church disciplinary council, or informal, private counsel and caution. Some general authorities also mentioned the statement during the October General Conference. Elder Boyd K. Packer, in what was the most explicit Sunstone reference, said, quote, "The natural man, Paul told us, receiveth not the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness unto him. Neither can he know them, because they are spiritually discerned." Recently, the Council of the First Presidency and the Quorum of the 12 Apostles issued a statement alerting members of the church to the dangers of participating in symposia, which concentrate on doctrines and ordinances and measure them by the intellect alone. If the doctrines and behavior are measured by intellect alone, the essential spiritual ingredient is missing, and we will be misled. There is safety in learning doctrines and gatherings which are sponsored by proper authority, end quote. Apostle Marvin J. Ashton said, quote, "Some of us may be inclined to study the word with the idea in mind that we must add much where the Lord has said little. Those who would add upon could well be guided by the anchor question of, do my writings, comments, or observations build faith and strengthen testimonies? Oftentimes we can cause confusion and misdirection in our lives and in the lives of others if we promote the startling and the unorthodox." Speaking on testimony, Elder Charles Didier of the 70 said, "Know by asking your Heavenly Father in the name of His Son, Jesus Christ. Do not turn to public discussions and forums," end quote. Meanwhile, back at the Lord's University, open deliberations of these complex issues began when the campus newspaper, The Daily Universe, ran a series on academic freedom, quoting BYU's 1986 accreditation self-study report that affirmed BYU's right to limit some faculty expression, including participation with Sunstone symposiums and dialogue. The debate came to a head when the Salt Lake Tribune ran an AP story reporting on a memo from the BYU Sociology Department to BYU President Rex E. Lee. The memo explained why the department's faculty felt continued participation at Sunstone symposiums was professional and constructive. The sociologists said they feared disciplinary action from the school or the church if they participated in these Mormon symposiums. Quote, "Such actions must be viewed as a constraint on academic freedom, especially for LDS church members whose employment depends on church standing," the memo said. The university would later strengthen the correlation between church standing and employment by changing teaching contracts to include that BYU teachers must be Temple Recommend worthy. The memo, which had received unanimous approval from all 20 faculty members of the sociology department, was intended to be private correspondence to President Rex E. Lee before it was leaked to the press. While chagrining some, the publicity did have at least one positive effect. It became an important catalyst in mobilizing and informing BYU faculty. For the next few weeks, numerous memos circulated the campus. Individual faculty members, department chairs, and groups wrote memos supporting the rights outlined in the sociology department memo. And still other memos defended the church's statement. Can I get a glass of water? Thanks. Several days after the AP story, the Universe ran an editorial labeling Sunstone Symposiums unacademic. In response, BYU law professor Edward Kimball said BYU and English BYU professor Eugene England wrote a letter in which they said the symposium was as academic as other professional conferences. Thanks. As other professional conferences they had attended, including BYU's Joseph Smith Symposium. David Knowlton, one of the parties that was at the center of the sociology memo and the Universe editorial, also wrote a letter to the editor defending Sunstone participation. In response to this and other campus tensions, a group of professors began meeting informally that February in what became known as the Ad Hoc Faculty Committee on Academic Freedom. The professors were concerned about academic freedom and the continued employment of some competent, non-tenured junior faculty, like Knowlton and Farr, whose public comments might jeopardize their employment. Some longtime BYU observers said they have never seen the faculty so independent or agitated. Over the next few years, as many as 200 professors would participate in these committee discussions. The aftermath. Despite the statement, about 1,500 people attended the 1992 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium, a record attendance figure. 1993 had similar attendance. It's unclear whether the statement has had a serious effect on satellite symposium attendance. Numbers were significantly down last year in Seattle, Chicago, and Boston. But with so many variables, like the weather, publicity, the timing, location, there's really no way of gauging just how much of an impact the statement had. In a Salt Lake Tribune story after the 92 symposium, Albert Peck said that while some BYU faculty chose not to participate, others made a point of participating. Peck said that the overall impact of the church's statement was to, quote, make presenters much more thoughtful and careful than they had been in the past, end quote. However, one professor who wasn't very careful was Eugene England. In a widely covered and reported session, he accused the then little-known committee of undermining the church. The brethren later acknowledged the existence of a strengthening church members committee that keeps secret files on members who criticize the church. Incidentally, England later apologized for the spirit in which he exposed the committee. The same Tribune article reported that several departments in the LDS church office building threatened employees with sanction if they chose to attend the symposium. Also, incidentally, the public affairs department sent six observers to the symposium, as they had done for years, and as near as we can tell, nothing has happened to them. And BYU. Well, BYU has always asserted that it has no official policy on whether faculty or staff can contribute to Sunstone or other alternate forums. Probably a more accurate statement would be that the university has no written policy discouraging participation. Some administrators have said there is an oral policy, not unlike BYU's oral policy that professors cannot be pro-choice. That extends only to department-level management and higher, but it doesn't extend to faculty. Others say there is a policy that extends to everyone. Still others maintain there is not a policy whatsoever, and there never has been. The following are several professors' experiences in trying to nail down BYU's position on participation at Sunstone. Douglas Campbell, a tenured professor in computer science, decided he wanted to present a paper on the history of textual changes in the Book of Mormon. He wrote the paper, gave a copy of it to his department chair and dean with a note explaining that he was planning to present it at the Sunstone Symposium, and they should contact him if there was any problem. He was later informed by his department chair that no one found anything offensive about his paper, and he should go ahead and present it. Bert Wilson, director of the Charles Redd Center, was on leave when all the statement on symposium stuff was released. He says he didn't pay much attention to the talk, but became interested when Albert Peck asked him to present a paper on Mormon humor. He wrote a letter to his chair asking him to put any existing policy in writing. The chair later told him there would be no policy in writing, but then made it clear to Wilson that there was an oral policy. Wilson withdrew his name from the symposium program. Margaret Young, a part-time English professor, was interviewed for a position at BYU Hawaii with Elder William Bradford. During their discussion, he said, So, as a BYU professor, you won't be publishing in Dialogue or Sunstone, will you? She said, well, yes, actually, I will. I have a story in the next Dialogue. She's a fiction writer. And one set for publication in a future Sunstone. He said, oh, just a second. Let me make a call on that. Young says Bradford called Church Commissioner of Education, Hal Eyring, and the half of the conversation she heard went something like, oh, academic freedom, huh? Nothing right now? All right. Elder Bradford told her that there was no problem, but to use wisdom. A year later, Young became concerned that policies had been changed after hearing several conflicting campus rumors. So later, in an interview with Provost Bruce Hafen, she said Hafen told her that she should not be participating at Sunstone. Lynn England, chair of the sociology department, requested an appointment with Hafen in October of 1994. This was just a few months after Margaret Young met with him. England says Hafen told him that the university certainly prefers that BYU professors don't participate, but that there was no policy and would be no sanctions. Most recently, given what many hope is the final word, university spokesperson Brent Harker said in a Tribune story that there is no policy now forbidding students or administrators from participating. He also said there never has been one. In trying to sort through a situation that faculty say is painful and confusing at best, different professors have taken different approaches. Some participate, asking Sunstone to list pseudonyms in the program. Others only present at satellite symposiums, avoiding the publicity and media coverage in Salt Lake. Still others, like Bert Wilson, say, quote, I may not agree with the rules, but I'll follow them as long as I'm collecting a paycheck, end quote. It's also important to note that the statement has affected BYU participation at other conferences. For example, the annual Counterpoint Conference, sponsored by the Mormon Women's Forum, saw 19 BYU students and faculty withdraw from the program the first year. Most were from the English department and had been told by the chair that it would be in their best interest not to participate. This year, the same thing happened. All 7 BYU participants pulled out. Okay. Moving on to the Academic Freedom Statement. A committee appointed by the administration started work on the Academic Freedom Statement in July 1991, just a few months before the Statement on Symposia was to be released. The following spring, the university released a draft statement for faculty response that had been approved in principle by the BYU Board of Trustees. According to many BYU faculty, a good number of the suggested changes were incorporated into the final draft, creating a final product that provided more protection for the individual. For example, the final draft states that any limitation on academic freedom must be, quote, narrowly drawn so as not to impede the robust interchange of ideas, end quote. And the guidelines now acknowledge the freedom to, quote, discuss and advocate controversial and unpopular ideas, end quote. Of course, the document also explains what can get professors in trouble. It defines reasonable limitations on individual academic freedom at BYU as, quote, expressions that seriously and adversely affect the university mission or the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, end quote. Some examples cited in the document include expressions that contradict fundamental church doctrines or oppose rather than merely discuss official church policies, attack or deride statements that attack or deride the church or church leaders, statements that violate BYU's honor code through behavior or expression that is dishonest, illegal, unchaste, profane, or unduly disrespectful of others. Examples of issues that could result in sanctions against professors include teaching that Jesus was not a historical figure or that the Book of Mormon is not an ancient document. What is still unclear and what concerns some faculty is how the document applies to research on contemporary and historical Mormon issues. For example, one faculty member asked, how would it apply to the episode last fall when BYU sociology professor Tim Heaton was questioned about his public sharing of data on Mormon women's sexuality? Or those who report past or present unflattering church involvement in politics or unfortunate results of church programs or policy? End quote. It should be noted that BYU regards these so-called limitations below not as narrowing the scope of freedom, but as enabling greater, or at least different, and much-prized freedoms. After review by the faculty and Board of Trustees, the 10-page document became part of the university handbook. Some faculty continue to be uncomfortable with the document and feel that it might have a chilling psychological effect on research in Mormon issues. Quote, it might lead some faculty to be afraid to do research or take positions based on their data that don't agree with the positions of church leadership, end quote. BYU Sociology Department Chair J. Lynn England told the Salt Lake Tribune, quote, "As scholars, we need to be free to point out where church leaders have made mistakes," he said. Former BYU professor of political science Omar Kader agrees and adds, quote, "The problem arises when religion is elevated to a position of dominance and control over other departments in the university," end quote. BYU needs to recognize that the, quote, "inclusion of religion as part of a university education is as legitimate as the inclusion of chemistry or physics," end quote. Students on academic freedom. This is the part that chagrins me the most. Students, for the most part, were left out, or rather left themselves out, of the tumultuous academic freedom discussions. The Student Advisory Council, or SAC, led by Steve Turley, drafted a response in July 1992 to a preliminary copy of the Academic Freedom Statement. In his response, he expressed concern that many students had misunderstood the purpose of the document and felt that the statement directly impacted them. Turley advised that in the final draft, the committee stated explicitly that the document does not in any way govern the behavior, research, or discussion of students. SAC acknowledged that, nonetheless, the document, even with these acknowledgments, the document would affect the students in that, quote, "the students are the direct recipients of what the faculty can and cannot express," and that the document affects the faculty and teachings to which the students will have access, end quote. The Student Council attempted on several occasions to raise student consciousness on academic freedom issues, usually finding only apathy. In one such attempt, a SAC-sponsored soapbox speak out. This happened at noon one day during lunchtime. Turley, after 20 minutes of begging for participation, he was on top of the soapbox, grew frustrated and started yelling. Eventually, Turley's efforts were rewarded. One student clambered atop the soapbox and said, "Would someone tell this guy to shut up? I'm trying to get a date with this girl here." To my knowledge, that's the extent of student participation in academic freedom debates. Still, there were students who were concerned about how the statement affected them. A year later, during the annual pre-fall teacher's assistant training, a few TAs asked Associate Vice President John Tanner if the document applied to them. In response, Tanner sent the group a copy of the document with a short cover letter stating, quote, "You'll note in footnote 1 that we developed these elaborate policies for faculty only. The policies govern all faculty whose contracts bear a presumption of renewal. This is not the case for TAs who are typically on short-term contracts with no presumption of renewal." So this is about all we have as far as where the academic freedom statement, how the academic statement applies to students. The university conferences. At the annual university faculty conference in late August, several months after the statement had been released, President Lee said that the university was basically sound. Quoting John Milton, Justice Holmes, and John Stuart Mill, Lee said that, quote, "truth can be best pursued in an atmosphere free from unwarranted inhibition on the development of expression of thoughts and ideas." Lee said that because BYU also celebrates the religious aspects of intellectual life, its faculty, quote, "enjoy a greater measure of academic freedom than at any other school." This is, of course, an interesting evolution from earlier statements that BYU had different, or admittedly not as much academic freedom as other universities. Lee also defended the need to preserve institutional over individual academic freedom and applauded the limitations in the students. I forgot to mention earlier, but Lee also said at this conference that the church's 1991 statement on symposia was issued to all church members and thus included BYU faculty. Lee warned, "In some contexts, agreeing to speak itself carries an implied endorsement of the symposium." And he added, "If there has ever been a comparable statement during my lifetime, I cannot recall it. I hope we take it seriously." This led some people to wonder if the church statement giving the blacks the priesthood was maybe in subservience to this one, or exactly what he meant. At the same conference, Provost Bruce Hafen talked about an expansive view of the mission of BYU that embraces all truth, but which, quote, "gives priority to the truths that lead to Christ. We cannot allow our most sacred premises to be altered or even minimized by secularist assumptions," he said. Hafen warned that many spiritual casualties are inflicted, quote, "inflicted when a thoughtful student senses or even through subtle hints that a BYU teacher she respects is cynical about the church, end quote. He acknowledged that educated people may have troubles with the church issue, but said that the public expression of them is not an issue of intellectual integrity or educational depth, but one of judgment. Hafen said public expression of disagreement conveys, quote, a cynicism about the divining influence in a church debate and a church based on prophetic leadership, end quote. He counseled private communication over public expression that, quote, may simply spray another burst of spiritual shrapnel through the ranks of trusting and vulnerable students, end quote. Later that semester, in a religious education faculty lecture, Robert Millett, Dean of Religious Education, gave a paper that expressed some of these same themes. He also, however, contradicted Lee's notion that BYU has more academic freedom. There is a, quote, rather painful reality. It is extremely difficult for faith to survive in a purely academic climate, he said. Quote, the fact of the matter is that we do not have academic freedom at BYU in exactly the same sense that we might have it elsewhere, end quote. Millett explained that, quote, the apostasy was long and deep and broad. It made its way into every phase of human endeavor and study, not just religion. Its pull was on the humanities. Its effects are now felt in the social and behavioral sciences, the arts. Indeed, in all avenues of human inquiry, end quote. Some felt Millett's statement that, quote, the people in a covenant society are committed to a cause higher than anything earthly. They have matured beyond the point where they feel any desire to rebel or bristle under standards, end quote, was a cheap shot. The Church on Academic Freedom. In the middle of the continuing heated campus discussions, Elder Boyd K. Packer raised the temperature with his comments during the October 1992 General Conference, quote, for those very few whose focus is secular and who feel restrained as students or teachers, there are over 3,500 colleges and universities where they may find the kind of freedom they value, end quote. Many faculty were angry at Elder Packer's remarks and resented that he called them employees when the traditional model for a university is a community of autonomous colleagues. Some said they felt Elder Packer did not respect or trust them. The following week, during a BYU devotional address, President Gordon B. Hinckley took a more healing tone. Quote, you have the trust and the confidence of the governing board, he assured the faculty, whom he called colleagues. I am confident that never in the history of this institution has there ever been a faculty better qualified professionally, nor one more loyal and dedicated to the standards of its sponsoring institution, end quote. Nevertheless, he added that, quote, that trust involves standards of behavior as well as standards of academic excellence. It's not that we don't trust you, but we feel that you need reminding of the elements of your contract with those responsible for this institution. Every one of you here has accepted a sacred and compelling trust. With that trust, there must be accountability, end quote. Cracks in the surface. In May of 1992, BYU was informed that Phi Beta Kappa, the National Honor Society for Liberal Arts and Sciences, had rejected the university's third bid for a campus chapter. Explaining that BYU's mission statement precludes open inquiry among students and a lack of professors who are Phi Beta Kappa members and provincialism among the few that the university does have, 13 of BYU's 20 Phi Beta Kappa members came from the University of Utah. Phi Beta Kappa National Secretary Douglas Ford said, quote, if students are unable to question, there is no liberal arts education. Open-ended inquiry is part of the liberal arts education experience. Questions should not be precluded, end quote. Despite administrators' attempts to soften this third blow, frustration surfaced in press and media quotes. BYU Provost Bruce Hafen and Phi Beta Kappa was, quote, naive and misinformed about pluralism and religious liberty in the First Amendment. Neil Rasband, Associate Dean of General and Honors Education, is a Phi Beta Kappa, and he was the one who submitted BYU's Phi Beta Kappa application. He said, quote, we do not need Phi Beta Kappa. If they demand that we abort our mission, we will simply go our separate ways. There are other Honor Society chapters here. Later, Stan Albrecht, Academic Vice President, said that the reasons that Phi Beta Kappa gave for the denied bid were unfounded. Quote, they have egg on their face. They seem to be rationalizing their poor decision, end quote. BYU's officials added later that they would reapply for a chapter sometime in the future. A month later, rumors surfaced that there was a list of professors that the Board of Trustees had identified who should not be at BYU. With one exception, all were younger, untenured faculty. While the administration specifically denied there was an official list, it became known that there were indeed faculty members who had been noted by at least one general authority and discussed with BYU administrators because of their environmental, feminist, and Mormon stands and writings. The academic freedom controversy also has made it difficult to hire new faculty. Qualified candidates for tenure-track positions in several departments have withdrawn their names for consideration and have specifically cited academic freedom tensions as the reason. For example, I'm not sure if I'm saying this name right, Astrid Tumanex, I don't know if anyone knows her. She is a BYU graduate who recently received her PhD in political science from Columbia College. She told the Salt Lake Tribune that she was concerned about accepting an invitation to join the faculty if it meant choosing between secular and revealed truth. Quote, I don't want to be in a situation where I feel paranoid and have to watch out for everything, she said. If the church meddles too much in the university or takes a dictatorial stance on intellectual issues, I would have problems taking a job there, end quote. The controversy came to a head when it was announced during the summer of 1993 that both professors Farr and Knowlton had been denied continuing status and would be leaving the university the following year. Many people were aware, on and off the campus, that both Farr and Knowlton were outspoken young faculty members who had received a lot of media coverage during a few controversial moments of their 3 years at BYU. Both, however, received high teacher evaluations and had publishing records comparable to others who had passed their third year reviews. This left many stunned when BYU told the media that the firings were a result of scholarship deficiencies, not citizenship. The firings mobilized students and faculty, resulting in several protests and national media coverage. Numerous issues were at play. Many were angry at the apparent lack of honesty in statements by the university. Quote, if they were fired for citizenship reasons, just admit it, some said. Others were angered that Farr and Knowlton were held to standards, the academic freedom document, that was not only unarticulated when they were hired, but it didn't even exist until several months before they were fired. Also, in Knowlton's case, with his extensive participation with Sunstone, some felt it wasn't correct that his citizenship suffered, even though there was no written campus policy. The same is true for Farr and her anti-abortion pro-choice stance. She suffered because of another unwritten policy forbidding BYU professors from taking a pro-choice position, but anti-abortion. These situations and others fly in the face of the AAUP and NWAA stipulation that private religious institutions can have academic freedom limitations as long as they are clearly defined. With his university and firing procedures under attack, Lee submitted an opinion piece to the Tribune declaring, quote, Brigham Young University is dedicated to the ideal of the church university, a place that combines faith in God with the pursuit of highest academic achievement. Institutional compromise on either aspect of this ideal is unacceptable, end quote. All right. Let's see. In June, following the announcement of Farr and Knowlton's firings, the Ad Hoc Committee on Academic Freedom released a statement explaining that they weren't charging any specific administrators or faculty members with wrongdoing, nor discrediting the review process. Quote, we do feel, however, the committee wrote, that problems exist with how the process has been implemented. They went through and outlined a number of suggestions. Most of them were in direct response to problems they felt that existed in Cecilia Conchar Farr's case. And they suggested that departmental decisions should bear more weight than is currently the case, that people should be pulled off the review committees that have particular biases against certain perspectives, like feminist perspectives or postmodern perspectives, that the administration and board meet regularly with the faculty to involve them in crucial university decision-making processes, etc. Other faculty and student positions. There certainly were many BYU faculty members that were content and still are with the system and still support BYU and its decisions. Some letters to the editor and editorials, like this one, took an Elder Packer stance. Quote, why stay if you don't like it? I personally would have a hard time taking a check from the LDS Church and then working to destroy what the church stands for. That was from a BYU professor. And then in December, 32 professors signed a statement that expressed support for the administration and its hiring and firing process. Also, the Daily Universe ran a story about students who were protesting the protesters. Farr and Knowlton deserve to go if they were not following the brethren, one student said. They sure don't belong at BYU with that attitude. Conclusion. According to some who have been involved with BYU for many years, these academic freedom-related issues have put faculty morale at an all-time low. There is widespread lack of confidence in the administrator's ability to protect professors' independence. Reportedly, even many deans criticize Provost Hafen's administrative style and privately say they don't trust him to deal honestly with them. Some faculty members have said that they are afraid that they are tired of not being valued, of having their testimonies questioned by other faculty, and are seeking positions at other universities. Others have noted that BYU is fortunate to have this controversy at a time when the faculty job market is so dry. Both the Salt Lake Tribune and the New York Times have run stories about faculty discontent and flight, reporting that up to 20 faculty have sent out resumes because of the situation. Faculty members like Tomi Ann Roberts, Bill Davis, Marty Bradley, Martha Beck, and Hal Miller have already left BYU. So what does all this mean? Some say it's clear, as Gary Bergera, author of BYU's unofficial history, A House of Faith, explains. Quote, in the eyes of its sponsoring institution and board of trustees, BYU is first and foremost a religious institution devoted to the inculcation of Mormon doctrine. It is secondarily and only in subservience to this paramount religious goal that BYU is committed to the challenging rigors of secular academics and cutting-edge intellectual thought. End quote. So are religious orthodoxy and the intellectual freedom necessary for higher education simply irreconcilably contradictory components, like humanist writer Vern Bullock says? Omar Cater, former BYU professor of former BYU political science scientist, believes so and says, the church must, sooner rather than later, relinquish control over BYU, or it will have to destroy the institution with smothering control. But Michael McConnell, however, in Academic Freedom in Religious Colleges and Universities, writes that there is a legitimate, even crucial place for institutions like BYU. Quote, religiously distinct colleges and universities make important contributions to the intellectual life of the faculty, their students, and the nation, and secular academic freedom in its unmodified form would lead quickly to the extinction of these institutions. The insistence on a single model of truth-seeking is inconsistent with the anti-dogmatic principles on which the case for academic freedom rests. And even if the extension of secular academic freedom to religious institutions were desirable on intellectual grounds, it would subvert the ability of religious communities to maintain and transmit their beliefs and thus undermine religious freedom. The last few years' debates are seen by some as the defining period of the university's history. Will BYU continue to grow in stature in the academic community, or will it become Bob Jones University of Mormonism? We've learned in recent conferences that the church will not divest itself of BYU, that professors there already have more academic freedom than their colleagues at other schools, that things will likely continue in the way they are headed, and most of all, that if you are out of step, you become expendable. So, with all that said, I asked one BYU professor, why do you stay? And he said to me with tears in his eyes that he stays because of the students, because he was a thoughtful, liberal student at BYU and found a haven in other professors and was able to share his ideas and learn from them. And he would like to provide that for other students, no matter how challenging and how painful it is for him on another level. Thank you.
She informed me I have to keep it to 6 minutes. I want to begin by quoting an ancient American prophet. Oh, the cunning plan of the evil one, the vainness and the frailties and the foolishness of men. When they are learned, they think they are wise, and they hearken not to the counsel of God, for they set it aside. Supposing they know of themselves, wherefore their wisdom is foolishness, and it profiteth them not, and they shall perish. But to be learned is good, if they hearken unto the counsel of God. BYU, as Brian has pointed out, has a dilemma of balancing the idea of academic freedom with that of its self-imposed standards. BYU is not alone. Many universities face similar problems. One recent example is the University of Virginia, where the school will not fund a religious paper, even though they fund other groups. They feel it violates church and state. I dare say that this is a restraint of academic freedom. As another example, Stanford University instituted a regulation prohibiting some kinds of speech. It was recently held invalid by the court in Santa Clara County. Again, this is a suppression of academic freedom. The buzz phrase on campuses today is political correctness. If you disagree with someone that is politically correct, you can get into similar trouble to that of some professors at BYU. Many conservative students and teachers throughout the country are disciplined when they disagree with the controlling powers of universities. When this happens, the attitude taken by the press and the students is one of good riddance. However, the press and many students are ready to provide assistance when someone is released whom they believe is politically correct. The Mormon Church has a different view of the purpose of education. My understanding of that view is that education is for the benefit and building of the kingdom of God. To that end, BYU was established. It was established to balance the worldly effect of academics on its people, to provide an atmosphere of safety where one can believe the teachings of the church and not be afraid that someone will ridicule you for your devotion to those beliefs. At many universities, Mormon students are singled out for their beliefs and ridiculed for their beliefs. Their beliefs are challenged. Some teachers take it upon themselves to destroy the student's faith. BYU does not want to see this happen so long as the church is paying the cost of operations. All universities dance to the tune of those who control the purse strings, and academic freedom is allowed so long as it agrees with those who pay the bills. If it challenges the people who pay the bills, it is not allowed. This has always been the case, and it will always be the case long after we are gone. I believe that at BYU there is not the same kind of academic freedom there may be at other universities. I also believe that the church should allow more discussion on all topics, but that they do have a right to protect the school from those who want to make BYU another Berkeley, where too many things are accepted as okay. I believe that there is a line between discussion and disagreement. Discussion is always good. Perhaps BYU should reflect upon the quote that Joseph Smith made when he was asked how he governs these people. His response was, "I teach them correct principles and they govern themselves." I heard these leaders quote this while I was at BYU and often wondered what it meant at BYU. BYU might do well also to follow the admonition given by the Lord to Oliver Cowdery in the 9th section of the Doctrine and Covenants, where Oliver is told, quote, "Behold, you have not understood. You have supposed that I would give it unto you when you took no thought save it was to ask. But behold, I say unto you that ye must study it out in your mind. Then ye must ask me if it be right. And if it be right, I will cause that your bosom shall burn within you. Therefore, you shall feel that it is right." Close quote. How can one study it out if there is no discussion allowed? How can one even begin to make a decision without all of the facts? I feel that the Lord is not afraid of discussion, in fact, encourages it as a means to grow and learn and to understand the truth of all subjects. One last item. Regarding the professors who were denied tenure, I'm not fully aware of the circumstances as to why they were let go. If indeed there were lies told by BYU leaders, that is wrong. If, however, they violated the code of conduct that all professors and students must adhere to, then BYU had the right to let them go. In conclusion, to say that BYU is so terrible in its academic freedom is to overlook the fact that there is no academic freedom, no matter the university. All academic freedom is relative. If BYU is such a repressor of academic freedom, why are there more students than BYU can handle? In an age where most private colleges and universities are struggling to find and keep students, BYU has a cap on the number allowed to attend. It has had to raise its qualifications for those applying for entrance. There is always a minority who will attend BYU and not have a pleasant experience, but a far greater percentage have a positive learning experience. I know. I enjoyed my sojourn at BYU, and yes, I found it narrow-minded at times, and being from California, I found it conservative at times also. But I would gladly attend there again. In fact, I hope at least one of my children will attend BYU. Thank you.
And it's important that the questions go on the mic. Brian, why don't you come up here, and I'm going to let him choose those who have questions. He will need to rephrase the question on the microphone so that it can go on the tape. So please make your questions concise.
I don't pretend to be a good spook. So what will happen to accreditation at BYU? I don't pretend to be a spokesperson for the university or even understand all the issues, so I'll give you my best shot on all these questions. As far as accreditation, BYU is now in the middle of a self-study in which they pass out hundreds of faculty questionnaires and do interviews and focus groups and try and figure out just what people think of BYU. The major study was done in September, and the results have just been released. Well, they haven't been officially released, but in talking to professors at BYU, the number one problem right now is that there is no trust between the faculty and the administration. And that distrust obviously is not enough to affect accreditation. What is enough to affect accreditation is when BYU subverts its own system, like the AAUP stipulates you need to have any kind of faculty restrictions in writing. And BYU has this, you know, you can speak at the symposium, no, you can't speak at the symposium, this back and forth, that's not in writing. And so if professors are, like David Knowlton was, are punished because of it, then that is something that could affect accreditation. Same with BYU's oral policy that you can't be pro-choice. Since Cecilia Conchar-Farr was also pinged on that, that goes against could go against accreditation. Most people really, though, think that nothing will happen, that BYU will be reaccredited. It may get a couple of slaps on the wrist, but it's not an issue, really. Yes?
As a retired school librarian, I'm concerned about limitation to access to books in the main library or in the bookstore on church standards, because having read some contemporary fiction, you know, you're not going to put it on a reading list for Beehive Girls. But on the other hand, how can you teach advanced American Lit class or your literature class with books that are great literature but have passages that, if they take them out of context, are really going to curl your hair?
Certainly, yeah. The question is one of censorship. If BYU students have access to all of the cutting-edge literature and writings that will enable them to get a full education. And that's a great question. As far as the bookstore goes, I think the woman in charge there, her name is Linda Brummett, and she is wonderful. She has turned that place around, from what I understand, and they stock pretty much everything. You can find what you want to find. And it's not that it's behind the counter or anything. It's there. On occasion, she gets complaints from alumni or faculty. More often than not, it's BYU students. And then she'll have to scale back and only stock one copy, or, you know, students will have to come up to her and she'll have to special order them. Anyway, she's wonderful. Now, as far as the classroom goes, I had a number of courses in which the professor began the semester with a big disclaimer. You are about to go into hell. This class is a class on postmodern theory, and we are going to be reading the scatological, the sexual, the vulgar. And that's part of postmodern literature. You cannot study it without reading Thomas Paine. If you don't like it, if this is going to bother you, then please leave. Don't attend this class. It's not for you. It's not a required class. Find something else. And almost invariably, there will be students who will stay. You know, they'll think, it can't be that bad, or it's not going to bother me. They become offended. They write a letter that goes up to the Board of Trustees. The letter is read by, you know, the entire board, and then passed down the whole university hierarchy, making pit stops at all the little points along the way, finally reaching the professor some 6 weeks later, usually. And then they're asked by their department chair to respond to this anonymous letter. In fact, most recently, I know I'm going off your question, I'm sorry. Most recently, there's a problem, and some of you are on the internet or read the papers, may have read about Brian Evanson. He's a BYU professor who wrote a very violent book. It was published with Knopf, and a BYU student read it and sent an anonymous letter that did that whole chain, and now he's under fire. So anyway, this is a huge problem that professors are dealing with now. Yes?
You talked about students, faculty, administration, governing board. Let that one group, the alumni. Has there been any reaction from alumni? Are donations up, down, about the same?
How about the alumni? Are donations up or down? Have they had any impact? I don't really know. From what I understand, though, in talking to people who do know or think they know, the alumni is very conservative, and the alumni that is liberal really doesn't say or do much. It's the conservative people that write the letters that, you know, possibly threaten to pull their donations. And so it's not much of a help. Yeah.
How much activity has there been on the part of more conservative alumni threatening to withhold funding?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
How much activity has there been on the part of the more conservative alumni or anyone threatening to withhold donations because BYU is turning into its supposed cesspool of liberalism?
So how much threat has there been to withhold donations? To be honest with you, the stories I know are anecdotal, I can't even verify them. The only confirmed story that I've heard doesn't even have to do with these academic issues. It was, if you don't get my son in, I'm pulling my money. I believe it's not unique. Yes?
I was going to ask in your role at Sunstone, what effect, if any, has either statement had upon the participation of these intellectuals in Sunstone, either by way of publication or at symposium?
So the magazine or the symposium?
Has it been limited, or has there been a noticeable deprivation of that kind of activity, or at least the diminution of that kind of activity at Sunstone, either in the publication or...
So what impact has the academic freedom document and the statement on symposia had on participation at the symposiums? And I mentioned briefly in my paper that BYU attendance is way down, that some BYU professors who do attend use pseudonyms in the programs, attendance in the satellite conferences are down. Now, what I wanted to do, to be honest with you, is go through and chart actual faculty participation, BYU participation. I wanted to say, in 1991, we had 50 BYU professors, blah, blah, blah. In 1992, after the statement, we had 6, and they all used pseudonyms. But I decided not to do that because I didn't want this tape to go anywhere, and I didn't want people to transcribe it and knock these people and have names. I probably just did it by making that comment, so I should have done it anyway. In a longer manuscript in the book length version, I do have that. I do have those statistics and stuff, and I can talk to you a little bit later if you want. So, anything else?
Yes. Comments or just want comments?
Oh, love comments. Do you want to take the mic?
Not really.
Oh, that's pressure. But anyway, I gotta say, you know, I've thought a lot about this, and I have a set of feelings, comments. You know, the first is a church member. I guess I feel like, well, the board of trustees that funds the place really should be able to call the shots, and that doesn't bother me. The dishonesty that apparently took place in the review of the Farr and Knowlton cases really does bother me. I feel like, you know, we've had, well, the term is goal displacement. You know, we're dishonest in order to do something that's in accordance with a higher good, I suppose. As an alumnus, I'm really saddened because I'm afraid that the students there now won't have the same experience I did, the nurturing environment for all types of ideas, but yet from faithful professors who love the church and weren't threatened by ideas and didn't think anybody should. And as a faculty member at another university, I agree with Omar Cater. They can do whatever they want at BYU. Just don't call yourself a university. Call yourself a seminary.
Thanks.
We have time. Anyone has a pressing question? You can squeeze into a minute.
Or comment. Comments are great. We can use them in future presentations.
And I'm sure Brian would be happy to talk to you. Thank you for your...